So I would love to start with a little bit about how you get connected with your team, especially your DP for this film, Renan. I love his work with Meru and all of his beautiful work with National Geographic, but how do you build your crew?
In this case with Gather, I was, you know, I mean, I should say my previous film, Food Chain, I'd worked with an outdoor photographer named Forrest Woodward, who then was just a photographer and hadn't done any films yet. After making that film about farm worker rights with Forrest and with Eva Longoria and Forrest Whitaker, Forrest ended up becoming, you know, a pretty highly acclaimed photographer. One day when we were at an outdoor industry conference in Park Lake, or in Park City, you know, he took me to Renan's house. And I met Renan for the first time, and, you know, we really got on and spent time with Renan's wife, Taylor Reeves, as well, who's an environmentalist, who had actually watched Food Chains and, you know, knew some of my other work. And when it came time to start developing this new film, Gather, about Native American food sovereignty, I was trying to, you know, really find a DP that could shoot verite, but also, you know, could operate in some pretty harsh outdoor environments. We were shooting in South Dakota with a bison rancher and his daughter in like minus 24, minus 25 degree Fahrenheit weather. We were in rivers in Northern California. We were in deserts in Arizona. And I knew every step of the way that someone like Renan wouldn't be deterred or perturbed by any of those conditions. So when I reached out to him and said, "Hey, Renan, do you feel like doing something totally different? Not like a fancy car commercial. It's not a North Face spot. It's not some like high adrenaline outdoor sport film, but something that's a little bit more mellow, but at the same time will require a lot of physicality." He didn't hesitate. I was surprised, but I was also grateful.
Knowing that you did film all over the country, how did you logistically go about it? Like, what were the first areas you were at, and how do you work out such a massive schedule? I mean, I know in your previous work you've done major projects, but it's still, this must have been so daunting.
That's a great question, Gaddy. You know, the film's about Native American food sovereignty, and for those who have lived in America for tens of years, if not longer, or whose family stretched even further back, very, very few folks have had experiences in Indian country on Native American reservation. Mm. Really, unless you live in the Southwest, in Arizona or New Mexico, there aren't really large urban centers that are near Indian country. Actually, Seattle's also an exception to that. But most of us, even who travel on major highways, don't travel far enough off those highways to really get to reservations. That's just a way to say that reservations are as far away from the air traffic hubs as you can imagine. We shot quite a bit on the Yurok Reservation, which is on the Klamath River on the border of Northern California and Southern Oregon, kind of around the California state of Eureka. I flew 6 hours from New York to San Francisco. We would rent vans and SUVs, and we would drive to near 7 hours. We could have flown into Eureka, but on a small plane that probably wouldn't have been able to take all of our gear. When we went to visit our buffalo ranching family, you know, went from New York to Minneapolis, Minneapolis to Rapid City, and then a four-hour drive out to the buffalo ranch. And it was similar with our Apache characters, you know, in eastern Arizona, western New Mexico. So, you have a great point. It was logistically very, very difficult. You know, my producer, Tanya Mellier, and I spent a lot of time in development, traveling to these places just by ourselves, meeting characters, really planning things out, so that when we brought Renan to AC, our sound engineer, Tim Choi, our production assistant, Tanya, myself, sometimes another producer, you know, we could just jump right in and start shooting instead of wasting everyone's time.
What does it personally mean to you to have people like Eva Longoria and Jason Momoa get behind the causes that you are sharing with us? You know, and not just them, but your wonderful producing teams. I mean, what does it mean to you to know that people believe what you're saying is important to showcase?
Yeah, I've been really, really fortunate on Gather. My previous film, 3100, Run and Become, about ultra-distance running and indigenous ancestral running tradition. And my first film, Food Chain, about migrant farm workers, primarily in southern Florida, to work with really good people. Now, I think, you know, I was heavily influenced by a quote of Werner Herzog, who basically said, in paraphrasing him, that, you know, that the quality of a film is directly proportional to the oneness that a crew has. If your crew is constantly bickering, you don't get good material, no matter how good your characters are. So I understood that from the beginning, and just found people that I knew I could spend a lot of time in a car with. All my films have required a lot of traveling, either in cars or like flying into the middle of, you know, deserts in Botswana, the Kalahari, other wild places, highland forests in Japan, you know, and now Native American reservation. But primarily, it's like, do these people and I get along? And are they going to get along with our characters? As you know, documentaries are incredibly intimate experiences, and you have to be able to work with characters so that they can shine on camera. And so, and none of them are obviously professional actors, so everyone has to have such harmony and, you know, work really well together when the camera's rolling and when it's not. But when it comes to executive producers that I've been fortunate to work with, like Eva Longoria on my first film, Food Chains, and Jason Momoa on Gather, you know, sometimes when you have a topic about a really marginalized population, it's never going to get attention, particularly if you're doing the film to make some sort of change, if it's an impact documentary. So Eva got Food Chains on Bill Maher, on Seth Meyers, on Stephen Colbert. It looks like Jason's going to be on some of the Bed Nighttime talk shows as well. And even if those folks who watch don't watch the movie, he's going to be bringing up important topics and important points that everyone should be aware of. So sometimes, you know, having an amplifier like that is really, you know, critical to start raising awareness about the message.
I love that you use the word critical. How important is it to capture these stories of these natives in the fact that, I don't want to get into politics or anything, but the fact that there's still so many things going on that are negatively impacting their reservations, their lives. I feel like this documentary is something that, sadly, we may not be able to see in decades in the future. Does that scare you, or are you optimistic?
I'm totally optimistic. You know, everything is political. I'm not saying that it's just red or blue, but educating oneself about the democracy we live in and the roots of it is critical to understanding really where to go. Black Lives Matter has raised a ton of awareness recently that at the end of the day has really allowed people, whether they want to be a part of the movement or not, but they've really raised awareness of how policing tactics are literally a legacy of slavery. At the same time, if you want to look back at that early, early American economy, it was completely land-based. Like, there was no industrial revolution. There was no scaling. There was no, you know, like, gigantic factories, etc. It was all based on extracting value bit by bit from the soil. And so cash crops in the South, like tobacco and cotton, you know, were incredibly valuable. Subsequently, timber in the West became incredibly valuable. Getting land to graze cattle became incredibly valuable. But all that land was someone else's. when folks first started coming in, the 1400s, 1500s, and 1600s. The land that turned into farms on the East Coast were existing farms of Native Americans. The Midwest that became, you know, the Corn Belt was where really powerful Native tribes, you know, followed buffalo through the season. And so I'm just hoping that, you know, we can understand that there were people living here before the Europeans came over. Those people are still here, and all of us are technically living on their land. Now, there's no movement with Black Lives Matter for revenge. There's no movement amongst Native Americans to kick out every non-Native from North America. But I think it just requires us to ask a question of ourselves. Like, what are we doing to deserve to be on the land that we're on? And that boils down to the idea, the Native American idea, that nobody ever owns land. We're just stewards. Mm-hmm. And that requires reframing our relationship with our land and our environment.
One of the elements of the documentary that I love is it, I feel like with each different group that we visit, there is a push to teach the youth about, like you're saying, the history, but also about what can be the future. I think to Chef Craig and I feel like all of them are teaching younger generations. And then we get to see, like the young girl with the buffalo, these young kids doing great things. Can you talk about how important this film can be to the younger generations rather than just older generations watching this and reflecting, but younger generations taking something from it?
In Gather, we follow three main sets of characters. An Apache chef named Meat by Craig, who's just 39 or 40 in the movie, but we also follow a young female scientist, a high schooler at the point when we filmed, from the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation in South Dakota, Elsie Dubray. Mm. We also follow a group of kids on the Yurok Reservation. They call themselves the Ancestral Guard. They're salmon fishermen, but they're 23 and younger. And we try to make the film incredibly youthful. You know, the rest of us, I've already, you know, I'm 45. I would imagine you're no longer in your teens. kind of given up, you know, to a great degree on all of us, right? Because they say, like, every person, whether they kind of they're conservative or liberal as teenagers, as they grow older, they become more and more and more conservative. And, you know, to a large degree, you know, becoming more and more conservative, not necessarily a bad thing, but it means really just focusing more on your small little community or your family rather than on global issues. It's just part of you just doesn't have the time anymore. But when you look at kids, like, their minds are so fresh, they're so open, there's so much room for innovation, there's so much room for analysis. And if these kids, you know, really accelerate their own kind of knowledge of the world, as they become more conservative, it's markedly less conservative than us right now. And so we have a lot of kids in the movie because we want this movie to be something that, you know, people under 30 really resonate with. You see people that look like them, that are their same age, you know, with so much responsibility to try to change the fate of their people and the relationship of their people with the rest of the world.
I know you're in the throes of showcasing this film and getting this film out, but as fan of your work, can you share possibly what your next venture is, or are you still working so deeply in this?
Well, you know, the timeline for film, as you know, is not necessarily completely linear. So we finished the film in March of this year, 2020, just before New York City's post-production facilities got locked down. But we had pretty much finished editing the film last year. We were just waiting for our main character, Nephi Craig, to finish his arc, which was building an indigenous cafe. And so I had to spend some of my time constructively last year and began developing a narrative project about the greatest female runner that no one ever heard of. She was Nike's first female-sponsored runner in the 70s and early 80s. Her name was Patty Catalano, Patty Dillon now. But she was Native American. She was second place in the Boston Marathon 3 times. She was flown around by Nike on private jets to races. She held almost every American record between the 10K and the marathon. She was fierce, she was powerful, she was gorgeous. And everything bad that could have happened to a female athlete in the 70s happened to her. All of the conversations about equal pay, all of the conversations about, you know, paternalism and patriarchy in women's sports, you know, kind of started around her as the first major sponsored female athlete. And the story was too vibrant to just turn into a documentary where people were talking about her life in the past, because she's still alive. But a screenwriter friend, Alex Mellier, and I wrote scripts to try to capture just the drama of her story and keep the pace of it, you know, a lot faster than a documentary and with that kind of archival story could necessarily handle.
Wow. Sounds amazing. Wow. Can't wait for that. Sanjay, thank you so much for what you do. I think you're making a big difference, and thank you for giving me the time to chat with you. It was a real pleasure, and I love your work, and I especially love this one. It was really refreshing to see all these wonderful characters and people in our world. So thank you.
I mean, you are far too kind. I'm thankful for your time. Thanks for sharing your platform with me and spending this quality time together.